We have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No Maria this morning. She is working.
She is working and under the weather both, which is not a good combination, but you know, that's how it is.
Yeah. All right. So let's begin, starting with the local as usual, and our Governor Gregoire.
The Olympia special session drags along with the impasse continuing between the state Senate's Republican-passed version of the budget and the House Democratic version of the budget. And Gregoire came up with a proposed solution this week, exercising the leadership for which she has become known. It was not, as she proposed in her original budget in December, one that included any kind of revenue increase. Instead, her solution basically involved an accounting trick close the gap of some $300 million in the budget. Now, most of the simple accounting tricks have already been done because we've been, we've been facing revenue shortfalls and facing budget crises for the last several years in a row in Olympia. But this one had not been, and what it involves is, the state, serving as a clearinghouse for sales tax collections for county and local jurisdictions as well. It sets aside the amounts owed to counties and cities in a separate account and then remits those amounts to the counties and cities once a month. Well, what Gregoire wants to do is to keep those funds in the state's bank account, and they'll earn interest for the state while they're there. And then the state will, you know, eventually getting around to paying the counties and cities and other jurisdictions down the road sometime. Well, there's a reason this simple accounting trick hasn't been done before, which is that it has all kinds of dangers, particularly if the state runs into cash flow problems down the road or declares bankruptcy or anything like that. Then cities and locales become creditors, and become creditors that can get pennies on the dollar the same way any other bankruptcy creditor can get pennies on the dollar. And it also prevents localities from getting interest themselves on that money when it's not sitting in their bank accounts. So it takes money away from the cities and locales to get the state to pay its bills instead. This is irresponsible on a couple of levels. One, it's fiscally irresponsible because of the risk of a sustained downturn in the future impeding the state's cash flow. And, you know, we're already running into that, which is why we are in the problem we're in right now. It also takes money away from the counties and cities. And it also punts to the next governor, either Jay Inslee or, God help us, Rob McKenna, the question of what to do about a state tax structure that is fundamentally, structurally going to guarantee that we keep having these revenue shortfalls because the percentage of the economy that we tax is getting smaller and smaller and smaller because we don't have a progressive income tax in this state. This is the solution that Gregoire has come up with. It's not clear yet whether this is something that's going to unite the Senate and the House, but the alternative at this point seems to be either this or even more draconian cuts of the type that are in the Senate budget, because obviously both the Senate and the House have decided that the serious revenue increases are off the table this year.
Mm. So, and meanwhile, we have in town one of our local billionaires transferring $300 million into one of his foundations this week. And
yeah, he could write a check and cover that shortfall himself, but there's no return in it for him, so why would he do that?
Mm. All right, anything else on Gregoire's accounting tricks?
Not this week. We'll probably come back to it in the future.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. You mentioned Rob McKenna. He was also busy this week.
Yeah, Rob McKenna, for people who don't remember from his county council days, is originally from Bellevue. And, of course, you can't be a successful Republican politician from Bellevue unless you are in the pocket of Kemper Freeman. Kemper Freeman, the developer who we've talked about on this program before, who backed the anti-transit initiative last fall almost single-handedly and has been waging a campaign in the courts and at the ballot box and as a lobbyist for many years now opposing light rail. Well, he got McKenna to speak this past week before Freeman's East Side Transportation Association, and McKenna at that appearance vowed to oppose light rail across I-90. Now, this is not something that appeared in the Seattle Times, because the Seattle Times' news coverage is basically dedicated to making McKenna appear reasonable and moderate whenever it possibly can, because he opposes the state tax. But this is something that McKenna has not done very often on the campaign trail so far this year. He has been really at pains to try and avoid the appearance of being a doctrinaire Republican a la Scott Walker or Rick Scott or some of these other radical Republican governors that we've seen in other parts of the country. But this is a case in which both the courts and the voters have repeatedly weighed in that this is not only constitutional, but something that is desired by the public. And this is something that McKenna is vowed to want to saying he's going to work with Freeman and his allies to try and help stop on behalf of a very wealthy developer in the Bellevue business community. So just something to remember when you're considering whether to vote for Rob McKenna is that he will basically do anything that Kemper Freeman wants him to. And that is says oceans about what he would do as governor of the state of Washington.
Moving on to national and the ever-expanding NYPD scandals there.
Yeah, a lot of people who have not been paying attention over the past several weeks to the expanding scandal of the New York Police Department, where they spent several years post 9/11, really up until fairly recently when AP has had a succession of reports over the last several months detailing how they've been spying on Muslims, not just in New York City, but all over the northeastern U.S., Muslims who are not suspected of any crime or wrongdoing, but being surveyed on strictly because they are Muslim, and that included going to Muslim restaurants around the region, mosques and other houses of worship, community associations, whatnot, infiltrating those groups, making notes on you know, not just community leaders, but ordinary people who have done nothing wrong, flagrantly unconstitutional. And this program was carried out in conjunction with the CIA, which is not supposed to be spying on American citizens. Well, now it turns out with an additional report this week from the AP that it wasn't just Muslims that the NYPD was spying on. It was also left-leaning activists. And this was a program that was grew out of the 2004 surveillance that was done in advance of the Republican National Convention. And people may remember there have been a number of civil suits that came out of police behavior before and during that convention, which included illegal surveillance and included preemptive arrests. All of people who are well within their constitutional and legal rights. Turns out that the NYPD was spying all over the country on left-leaning activists who, as part of their so-called counterterrorism program. This included sending people to New Orleans for the People's Summit in 2008, at which reports that the AP got a hold on specifically named an international solidarity movement activist leading a workshop in Israel-Palestine and a labor organizer for housekeepers and nannies. It also identified groups working on immigrant laws, immigration laws, on labor laws, and, ironically enough, on racial profiling. Now, and as continues the long history of federal, state, and local surveillance on activists, they got much of the information wrong. For instance, that ISM activists, and remember, the International Solidarity Movement is specifically a movement dedicated to nonviolence in Palestine. So, why they are being investigated for counterterrorism, I will leave to your imagination. But it also turns out that the guy they named wasn't speaking at the People's Summit. He had introduced a film on Palestine that was at a film festival that was running in New Orleans that same week. That introduction lasted about 3 minutes, and he was kind of bewildered as to why the New York Police Department cared. Again, this something that expanded all over the country involving the NYPD, and now that maybe it involves good white liberals, this is something that maybe additional people will care about. But really, again, so far, Mayor Mike Bloomberg, New York's mayor, has defended his police department vociferously, and the Department of Justice, while it is looking into this, supposedly, there hasn't been a whole lot so far from the feds on this. The FBI has come out being critical of these investigations, because of course the FBI historically has been our go-to political police of choice in this country, and they don't like seeing their role usurped. But this is something that should be very, very worrisome, and it raises the question, of course, we're more than a decade removed from 9-1-1 at this point. How long are we going to tolerate having civil rights and civil liberties in this country abrogated on behalf of the ghost of 9-11?
It's a good question, and anybody has the answer, they can email that in.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Let's
call now, 1-800-STASI.
Operators are standing by.
Yeah, exactly. And they will be monitoring your phone call to ensure better customer service.
Let's move on. Speaking of budgets, another one trotted out this week from Paul Ryan.
Yeah, Paul Ryan, the Republican congressional front person for the idea of cutting everything except welfare for the very, very rich, trotted out his second take on a comprehensive budget reform this week. It was taken fairly seriously by the people who chin their strokes on national television, even though a lot of people who looked at this budget said, wait a minute, these numbers don't even come close to adding up. It wasn't a serious budget. It's a political document in an election year, and it was meant as a template for what the Republicans will run on this year. So what are the Republicans going to run on this year? It would cut taxes for the rich so sharply that basically Social Security, Medicare, and the military would be the only government programs left. Everything else would have to be abolished, more or less. He didn't actually say that, but that's how the numbers work out. It would eliminate all taxes on foreign profits. It would lower the top marginal income tax rate from 35% to 25%, eliminate the alternative minimum tax, raise defense spending, decimate spending on social spending, research and development, and as I say, pretty much everything else the government spends money on, certainly any kind of enforcement of laws that might constrain corporate behavior, and it would add hundreds of billions of dollars to the deficit. He wants to do this by reneging on the deal the Republicans made with the Obama administration during the debt ceiling fiasco last summer, and also ignore the sequestration process that led to automatic cuts in the military because of the failure of the reconciliation committee, super committee that happened in December. So what we can learn from this, number one, is the Republicans don't take their promises seriously, because they don't. This, again, is a political document. It shouldn't be taken seriously either, but this is being made to score brownie points with voters. It's not a serious governing document in any sense, but the fascinating part about this was that a number of the 2010 Republican class and Congress was saying this budget was not enough, that $10 billion in spending cuts was not sufficient, that it needs to be more than that, and therefore in good conscience they couldn't vote for this. Well, this is how the debate moves to the right in this country. You come out with a totally outrageous, ridiculous document, and then it's treated as a serious document that should be, you know, taken and studied over and learned from, because people on both the left and the right criticize it. And therefore, it must be a moderate centrist kind of document. It's not. It's an extremely radical document. And the fact that people even more radical are in our Congressional House of Representatives right now just speaks to the fact that voters in certain parts of the country were out of their minds 2 years ago. Hmm. And may still be. Who knows?
All right. Moving on, the GAO coming out with the report this week.
Yeah, if Paul Ryan and his allies in the Tea Party were serious about cutting the federal deficit, the General Accounting Office gave them a very good template for doing so. Ironically, the same day on Tuesday that Paul Ryan's budget came out, the GAO came out with a report on the Air Force's $1 trillion F-35 Joint Strike Fighter project. Now, this is a new class of fighter jets that has been in the works since the late 90s and is already become the most expensive weapon system ever in the history of the world. You may think I'm exaggerating. I'm not. This is a project that Lockheed Martin is spearheading, and the GAO reported that the F-35 will need years of additional work and unplanned fixes. It's already a decade late. It's already hundreds of billions of dollars over its original budget, and it's been plagued by mismanagement, safety concerns, and rigged test results, this according to the GAO. Now, this project could be scrapped after all the Navy and Army already have their own completely separate new generation of fighter projects going on as well. Certainly it could be cut back, but we don't talk about cutting projects like that because, well, you know, this is the only thing that we manufacture in this country anymore is weapons, and it means jobs, by God, even if it's just flushing money down the toilet.
And they go out of their way to spread those jobs out to as many legislative districts as possible.
Yeah, although if you were actually concerned about creating jobs, military spending is actually about the least efficient way in the economy to do it. You compare it to almost any other sector of the economy, whether it's healthcare, education, R&D for small business startups, whatever it might be. You know, it creates more jobs per dollar spent than military spending does, because military spending is so hardware intensive.
Hmm. All right. Moving on then to international, starting with Egypt.
Yeah, and we'll keep a theme here. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton restored military aid to Egypt this week, despite ongoing protests in that country over the anti-democratic tendencies of the ruling military council there that has basically usurped the democratic spirit of the revolution last spring. But we decided to restore military aid, even though there's still torture going on. There's still arrests of the democratic opposition going on, and all sorts of other concerning activities there. And why are we doing this? So as not to endanger contracts with arms makers. That's right. Lockheed Martin, the same folks who have the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, is scheduled to ship the first of 20 new F-16 fighter jets next month. And General Dynamics last year signed a $395 million contract to deliver component parts for 125 Abrams M1 A1 tanks assembled at a plant in Egypt. And these were specifically cited by Clinton as reasons for reinstating military aid to Egypt. So now that we're going to be providing the weapons with which Egypt can gun down its democratic protesters once again, we'll be in good shape for that, because by God, we'll be creating at least a few jobs here in the United States.
Wow.
It's good to know where our priorities are.
Did she give any other rationale for beyond that we got to keep the money flowing for?
Well, we have to honor our contracts too.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we couldn't possibly walk away from that just because, you know, people are being killed with our weapons in our name.
All right.
But we talked quite a bit at the time of the Arab Spring and the Egyptian Revolution. When it was happening last spring, that the history of the United States in these types of situations, where for a long time we have supported dictators. You know, we have supported dictatorships, and then we bail on them when it looks like they can't survive. But we do so in such a way that we try and keep the institutions intact, so as to, you know, so as to preserve having a cozy relationship with a favorable puppet regime, just under a different name. And we've seen this in Chile, we've seen it in the Philippines, we've seen it in Indonesia, and that seems to be exactly how it's playing out in Egypt as well. That, you know, now that international attention is not focused so firmly on Egypt, we're going back and making deals with a lot of the same people and our friends in the military, with which the United States had very close relationships all during the Mubarak regime, and all those same people are still running the country.
Mm. All right. Moving on, sticking with the Middle East and Africa, actually, Mali.
Yeah, North Africa even, because there was a military coup this week in the sub-Saharan country of Mali. Now, Mali in Western Africa is one of the countries that is adjacent to Libya and was directly affected by the NATO intervention and the fall of Gaddafi in Libya because an ethnic group called the Tuareg were among the fighters in Libya. Now, when the fighting in Libya was over, they came back to Mali and started an insurgency expanded an insurgency there with all the weapons they had gotten from NATO in Libya. And so we had a military coup in Mali this week of the democratically elected government there. Most of the military, including the officer who led the coup, has had U.S. military training. The Mali military works very closely with the United States because it's seen as a place in Western Africa where the U.S. can make a lot of headway in monitoring possible activity by Al-Qaeda. So there's a lot of counterterrorism work that goes on there. And so the U.S. works very closely with the Mali military, which overthrew a democratically elected government as a result of the dynamic that was set in motion by the U.S. Led intervention in Libya this past year. So once again, an unintended consequence of war, which happens a lot when you start or expand wars, and also yet another instance in Africa, as with Egypt, where the U.S. is siding with the military over a democratically elected government.
So have we heard any word yet that the U.S. will be upping its intervention in regards to Mali?
No, we have not.
I mean, if we've been helping with counterterrorism, you know, that generally.
No, but the U.S. also has been conspicuously silent so far on taking any kind of activities to suspend aid or otherwise condemn the coup.
Because it wasn't so long ago that the U.S. upped the number of advisors, I believe, to Uganda. So
Uganda, and also there's some Congo. U.S. advisor presence in the Congo at this point too.
So.
But those are different parts of the continent. But and again, this is all an expansion as well of the United States setting up a CENTCOM structure in Africa for the first time post 9/11. We didn't really have that much of a military presence in Africa historically, but that's dramatically expanded in the last decade.
And I know I just read recently that the court at congressional testimony that general admitted to the U.S. having special forces operations in like 120 countries in the world.
Yeah, well, we have bases and even more than that.
Yeah, but you tend to see as special forces tend to be active operations. So
yeah.
All right. Moving on then to Afghanistan developments there.
Yeah, it's just a cheery, war-filled kind of morning, isn't it?
It is.
The coverage this week continued of the aftermath of Sergeant Robert Bale's alleged massacre in Afghanistan 2 weekends ago now, with a lot of the coverage focusing on Bale's motives, and it was very interesting to watch the coverage in terms of the apologetics for some of those motives, that he had financial troubles, that he had marital troubles, that he was traumatized by his multiple deployments. That had head wounds, and therefore he must have just snapped somehow. Notice how we don't get those kind of excuses made when Muslims go off and massacre somebody or commit terrorist acts of one sort or another. So you know we're not hearing about the training procedures in Joint Base Lewis-McChord. We're not hearing about the history of soldiers coming from that base who've misbehaved in Afghanistan, who have come home and committed suicide or engaged in domestic violence or spousal abuse or rapes that have been committed and so forth. There have been a serious sequence now of troubles with that base, and we're not hearing about that. We're not hearing as the point that I made last week that the reaction among Afghanis is relatively muted compared to what it's been here in the United States because they are so accustomed to civilians being killed in Afghanistan, and they don't really see the difference between one soldier going off and doing it on his own and a whole team of them doing it as part of an operation or a drone from the sky bombing a wedding party. Now, This brings us to another curious thing that came out this week about the Bales investigation, which is that there really hasn't been much of one. The U.S. government has not, according both to Bales' attorneys and to Afghan witnesses, interviewed any of the witnesses on the scene. There has not been any scene crime investigation at all. There certainly has not been any investigation into the testimony by numerous Afghans that it was a team of Americans, or at least multiple soldiers, rather than just one soldier that engaged in the fighting. And so you have to wonder whether something is being covered up here. Because the story came out so immediately that it was Bales acting alone, even though there was eyewitness testimony that contradicted that. And then there hasn't been any investigation on the field, according to both Bales' people and the Afghan witnesses. You wonder what's going on.
There was also reports out this week that the in the day or two between when the incident happened and when it hit the press, that the Pentagon made extensive efforts to scrub Robert Bales' records from internet sites.
Yeah.
I don't know if you caught that. But.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that? Anything else on that?
No. Let's move on.
You actually wanted to end the show on an upbeat note.
Well. I know. This is
really
it's because
unusual.
Maria's not here. She's the Debbie Downer of the group.
So
we can say that since she's not here.
So developments or potential developments with the World Bank.
Yeah, good news yesterday, and this is not necessarily usually where you get a good news, is an economic appointment by President Obama. Most of his economic appointments during the course of his tenure have been pretty bad, and his pending appointment for the presidency of the World Bank was thought that he was going to, again, not do very well. Larry Summers was a name that was mentioned very frequently. John Kerry came up as a potential appointee as president of the World Bank. But instead, he nominated Dartmouth College president Jim Yong Kim, who was originally born in South Korea, to become the new president of the World Bank. Kim is the former director of the World Health Organization's HIV/AIDS section, and has actually spent most of his career working on poverty issues in the international arena. It is the first time in the history of the World Bank, a post-World War II institution that was supposedly founded specifically to alleviate international poverty, is the first time a president of a World Bank actually has a history and a record and an expertise in anti-poverty programs. And so assuming that Kim gets approved by the Senate for his nomination, This is good news. It's something that is being applauded on the left and the right, at least in the last 24 hours since the appointment was made. And, you know, hopefully he won't be co-opted like so many World Bank presidents before him into becoming part of the problem. But at least he's starting from a better place than any previous World Bank president ever has.
All right. Events.
Yeah, we got several events coming up this week, as often happens this time of the year. Today, between noon and 2 o'clock, a forum on women and water, bearing the burden, sponsored by our good friends at LILO. That'll be at the Southside Commons Space for Progress Auditorium at 3815 South Edmonds Street in Seattle. Tomorrow afternoon, 4 p.m., there will be a March for Justice for Trayvon Martin that will be at the Greater Mount, or will start anyway, at the Greater Mount Baker Baptist Church at 2425 South Jackson Street, and the organizers are suggesting that you wear a hoodie to that. By all means, go and participate in that. And then on Monday at 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall, Gil Samak Liman will be speaking on the real lives of Afghan women. That'll be $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle. And then on Thursday, 7 p.m., there will be a kickoff party for I-103, the Party to End Corporate Rights. I-103, for folks who haven't heard about it yet, is the initiative campaign that's trying to get enough signatures to get on the November ballot that would do something similar to what Envision Spokane did last year with having a bill of rights for citizens and an attack basically on corporate personhood and corporate bill of rights. That's an effort that's going to try and get on the ballot here in Seattle this November. We'll be talking a lot more about that once that campaign gets underway. Anyway, that will be this Thursday at 7 p.m., a party for that at United Temple
University Temple,
United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in Seattle, in the U District.
These churches with five words in their title. Talking, as we do every week, with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
People find Eat the State at www.eatthestate.org. And Maria also has a website when she's not sick and overworked. She still has it. She posts to it when she's not sick and overworked at www.mariatomchick.com.